The Sunstone Foundation presents the development of RLDS theology, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Annalyn, I welcome you here, remind you, as you have been reminded in other sessions, that taping is being done exclusively by an authorized company, I guess, and that individual taping is not allowed. The purpose of this particular panel is to describe RLDS, Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saint theology, and its institutional development. I suspect this audience is composed primarily of Mormons, mostly of the Brighamite camp, and who are probably not well informed about our cousins from Independence. And while this session is not meant primarily to discuss just differences and similarities between the two Mormon churches, such comparisons undoubtedly will be inevitable to some extent in the discussion here today. It's scheduled for 1.5 hours, including questions from the audience. We'll begin with each panelist presenting an opening statement, scheduled not more than 15 minutes each, and then we encourage you to be thinking of questions, since this should be primarily a time when you can tap these resources that we have with us to learn more from them. Also, I'm going to ask that each of the panelists give a brief personal background. I'm going to give introductory information on each, but for them to each give some personal information about themselves, how long they've been in the church, something that will help us to know them a little better. And it has been requested in the formulation of this concept that each of them, at some point in their comments today, comment on the topic or the concept of one true church. So we will begin with, I'll introduce them all, and they will proceed in the order that I introduce them. First of all, Paul Edwards is familiar to regular Sunstone or MHA attenders. He comes to this panel well qualified. He's currently director of Temple School Division in the RLDS Church, having previously served as vice president and dean of the faculty at Graceland College, where he also taught a number of subjects, including, I believe, philosophy and history of the church. He received his Ph.D. in philosophy at St. Andrews University in Scotland and has authored books and articles. His articles have appeared in literally all of the journals that intellectuals are familiar with in the Restoration Movement. He is author of Inquiring Faith and has recently provided us with A Preface to Faith, a book, a session on which took place yesterday as part of this symposium. He is an accomplished historian and has been president of the Mormon History Association as well as twice president of the John Whitmer Historication, which I suppose could be regarded as the reorganized counterpart to the MHA to some extent. he is a great-great-grandson of Joseph Smith, Jr., and grandson of Frederick M. Smith, president of the RLDS Church from 1915 to 1946. Richard Howard is the historian for the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, with world headquarters in Independence, Missouri, in this position since April 1966. In 1976, he was also named Commissioner of History for the Church, one task of which is to direct the functions of the Commission on History, an advisory group concerned with matters related to church history. He serves on the Library Archives Planning Committee and is charged with the general care of the church's records management process, oral history program, museum, and the work of the various historians throughout the church's jurisdiction. Mr. Howard has been associated with the church's historical work since 1962. Before that, he taught history and public speaking in the Shawnee Mission High School District, Shawnee Mission, Kansas. He's a graduate of Graceland College, Lamoni, Iowa, the University of Kansas at Lawrence, and received the MA in History from the University of California at Berkeley. He has since taken further graduate studies at American University in Washington, D.C., St. Paul School of Theology in Kansas City, Missouri, and completed the coursework for the Ph.D. at the University of Kansas. He served 2 years in the CIC branch of the United States Army in 1955 and 1956. He's a member of numerous state and professional and historical associations, including the Mormon History Association, the John Whitmer Historical Association, of which he is president for the current year, 1985. His book, Restoration Scriptures, was given the Book Award by the MHA in 1970. for 16 years, from 69 to 84. He wrote a monthly church history column entitled Since Yesterday in the RLDS Family Magazine, The Saints Herald. He has also written for various historical journals and currently is at work on a one-volume history of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. 1953, he married Barbara Peavy of Mobile, Alabama. Barbara is an assistant editor of the Saints Herald and has authored and edited a number of books. They are parents of four children, grandparents of two. They live in Independence. For a contrast from these intellectual liberals, we have someone to represent the mainstream of the RLDS, I suspect, I hope. Sid Troyer is pastor of the Salt Lake City branch of the RLDS Church. He was raised in Springfield, Missouri. He's been at this assignment in this branch for 6 years. He's a salesman of steel pipe and tubing for the Marmon Keystone Corporation. He has a B.S. in business administration with an emphasis in accounting. He attended Graceland College for 2 years and then moved to Southwest Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri. He is married to Nedra Troyer. They have two boys, 14 and 15 years old. And then the final respondent, and is entitled in the program a respondent rather than a member of the panel, but not sure how that distinction will operate here, is Melody Munch Charles, our token LDS theologian. She has a master's of theological studies from Harvard. Her specialty is the Old Testament. She has presented work at the symposium since the days when it was meeting on the University of Utah campus. She has worked in the translation department of the LDS Church in what has been referred to as a think tank, one of the more liberal undertakings of the church, where they are creating commentary on the Book of Mormon for to be translated into other languages. She has published articles on the church and scriptures, one on Christianizing of the Old Testament and another involving women in the scriptures. She now lives in Colorado with her husband, Bob Charles, and her three children. Now that we've taken up all the time with the introductions, I don't know how much time is left. But we'll start with Paul Edwards, and he wanted me to prompt him a little bit. And so I'll just merely pass on some suggestions that Peggy Fletcher made when she created this concept here today. She suggested that Paul address himself to these subjects, but he's not bound to them, and he can do what he wants. But these are some suggestions: that he talk about the nature of God and humans, continuing revelation, Christology, Scripture and adding to the canon, and describe position papers and how they've influenced official doctrine in 15 minutes. Howard, to perhaps touch on relation to history, authority, Book of Mormon perception and status among the RLDS, building the city of Zion, and possibly any statistics that might be of any interest. And Troyer, possible subjects are priesthood and how callings are made, whether they have 12 apostles, who are appointees, what are appointees, the ordaining of women, which of course is very current, and lay clergy, missionary work and worship. And then Ms. Charles is invited to comment on any or all of the above.
Magnificent. I can never remember not being a Mormon. I've always been a Mormon of the RLDS variety. And I suppose in those early years prior to my baptism in my eighth year, I was outside of the full fellowship, though I think if someone had suggested that to me, I would have been confused by that. I don't remember an occasion when I've not considered myself not only a part of, but an essential part of a movement which I have always known through my entire life from the RLDS Independence variety. And I believed, I suppose, like most of my peers, first of all, that that was the only variety, and then the only real variety, and then the only variety that didn't stink, and finally discovered it was, in fact, only a variety. I've been asked to talk about theology, and I guess the reason for starting off in this fashion is to suggest to you in all of those years, and if I use the Dick Howard method of counting, which is different than everybody else, I'm a sixth generation RLDS. In all of those six generations, I don't ever remember seeing an RLDS theology or hearing one. What I have seen and heard over the years are articles by church leaders and officials. I have heard the accounts, verbal accounts, of a grandfather to some extent and a father to great extent. Accounts or statements, if you will, about position or attitude have read as widely as I know how in papers which would tend to be directive of those theological positions. And I guess my conclusion from all that is that we have kind of a general area in which we come down. And that general area is defined in some respects and totally undefined in others. And I suppose I would worry about this more if I found it was not also primarily true of the LDS. So given that bias, I suppose that's what it is, and the fact that I begin with a feeling that what I'm going to describe are some general ideas rather than some specific positions, let me move fairly quickly through what I think are the RLDS positions on these topics that Peggy has asked us to address. I know Gary was being funny and kind when he pointed out that there may have been a distinction between the attitude that I would hold as one of those liberal eggheads and the much more orthodox and conservative position of Brother Troyer. And I think you will discover that there probably is that kind of difference between any two RLDS. Certainly Dick Howard and I, though we have been friends for more years than some of you have been alive, don't agree on all given topics, and many of the things I may say may drive him literally from his chair to recount and to correct. Keep in mind, if you will, please, that we're a broad-based people. We're very eclectic people. We pull from a lot of varieties and a lot of places, and in the main try to amend or adjust that to our best understanding of Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, the Bible, and the inspired version of the Bible, all of which fall into the category of source and foundations for our beliefs. I think our position is fairly strong that the nature of God depicts a living being who is ultimate and absolute and eternal, and who is most of all personal, that he relates to persons in and through his Son, Jesus Christ, and that our relationship with him is a relationship of covenant. It is a new covenant made through Christ to alter the covenant made through Abraham, in that we no longer hold the position, that is, as human beings, that God is our God if and only if we maintain certain laws and certain positions, but the message of Christ that God is our God, irrespective of our reaction. And thus, we are obviously very strong in the camp of grace, even though I would indicate to you that most of our people that I have known over the last 15 or 20 years don't always like that. They don't like the word in the first place. And in the second place, they're not sure what's wrong with it, but there's a feeling that that's a little bit too something or other. There really ought to be a little works in there somewhere. And quite frankly, in my own personal life, it's hard for me to understand if grace is as I understand it, why I would not be better off sinning most of my life and repenting on my deathbed. So given that temptation, it's kind of hard for me to solidify that point too. God in our position is almighty, that is, he can do everything irrespective of his own limitations. He is infinite, he is unchanging. He is through and in all things, and thus is, in our opinion, transcendental. He is not known as or as a result of law or doctrine, even though there are laws and doctrines emitting from him. He is known primarily through the personality of Jesus Christ, and that he is known as he relates to us as persons. He has, I believe, all the characteristics that we don't have, and most of the terms used to describe him simply describe him as not being limited by human limitations, words like infinite and so forth. Men or individuals, men in a generic sense, men and women, fell with Adam, though I'm not really sure most of us know exactly what that means. We do seem to maintain the concept of original sin, even though that is not generally translated among our people as being all sin or sins of all. It goes back to a comment that was made this morning. Originality doesn't necessarily make it good or bad, it just makes it first. And what we're talking about is that, in fact, Adam sinned, and because of that, men have the heritage of the fact that men and women sin, not that they are stained or demented by that. All of us live, however, under the weight of human sin, and we see ourselves in a very, positive affirmation, but nevertheless an affirmation that human beings are in the process of struggling out from under the weight of and the restrictions of our own sin. I think the whole concept of the creation of persons is very confused in our thinking. We see creation primarily as a double creation, both a spiritual and physical, and we live with that dualism. God is involved in the process of our creation. We are in the process, I believe, of moving theologically from a position of preconception or preconceived souls. I made the obviously unwise statement recently of answering a question addressed to our Herald, Family Magazine. Someone asked about pre-existent souls, and I wrote in my response that I thought we'd gotten rid of everything but the language about that, and I discovered to my chagrin that that's not true, that there are at least 75 people out there who feel very strongly about it enough to waste 22 cents. So we're still learning about what we believe in that sense. But I still think that most of the literature that has come out in the past 15 or 20 years tends to deal with human beings in the sense that they begin in a spiritual and physical creation at an instant in time, primarily in the concept of conception. Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God and who is seen in a high Christological position, I think the RLDS Church would hold that, like most churches, Christ is 100% man and at the same time 100% God. And the fact that that doesn't add up right doesn't seem to bother us too much, because basically I think the church sees Christ on the divine side of this. That is, he is primarily divine. And as I have commented somewhere else, I think not without some trepidation, but I'll repeat it here. I think the RLDS Church has effectively used Joseph Smith as a means of expressing the human aspect of the divine counterpart, and thus have released Christ to be primarily the human aspect of that counterpart. So if I were to state, I think I would state that in general, the RLDS Church holds the position that Christ is predominantly divine. He is the vehicle by the way which we deal with God. We deal with God through Jesus Christ. We approach God through Christ, and we respond to God through Christ, even though both in our concept of revelation and in our concept of prayer, we address God directly. So there is, again, some confusion, I think, as to what that relationship is. I think the epistemology of revelation, that is, our concepts about how one knows through revelation, as it's expressed in the Book of Mormon, has created in the church a kind of Gnosticism that eats away at the very heart of the church itself. I think we were involved in a strange predicament between a very firm belief in continuing revelation, in the aspects that which state that God talks to and talks in an intelligent way to the contemporary prophet, and speaks to the church through the prophet. We believe that very strongly on the one hand, and yet on the other hand find it very hard to make any response to whatever might be said. That is, we're in this position of wanting to promote the concept of continual revelation, but not wanting to promote the concept of change that go with it. It is very hard to distinguish this, but I think in a very general sense, our people are more impressed with the fact of Revelation than they are with the information of Revelation. I think in a very real sense, Revelation is seen as a confrontation between the human person and God, and it is a fairly direct confrontation. It is a relationship which allows the human to understand something of the nature of the divine, and which is expressing the nature of the divine in the human. And as a result of this, we believe rather firmly that you get fairly direct informational guidance. The scriptures in the church are primarily the story of, or the narrative of, God's quest for human redemption, God's involvement in the human life, and his attempt to bring about the redemption of human beings. And it continues to speak, as it does in our Doctrine and Covenants, but does so in a very interesting way, I think, in which the scripture becomes instantly canonized by virtue of the common consent of the body. For those of you not familiar with our procedure, contemporary revelation is brought to the World Conference, presented by the prophet to the World Conference, and is voted on by the quorums, and then by the conference representatives at large. And it is a decision of that conference which makes legitimate, or if you will, which canonizes the words of the prophet. There have been some occasions in which the church saw fit to challenge or at least ask for more information about the nature of these positions. And I think the concept of common consent is very primary to the whole concept of Revelation and of Scripture as far as the church is concerned. The position papers, I suppose Peggy means by that the First Presidency. I'm not sure what Peggy means. There is a group of papers in our church known as the position papers, but that's, interestingly enough, includes three or four different groups of papers. So let me just talk about what I think she's getting at. I think she's talking about the fact that in the early 60s, the church faced some very, I think, very significant and very contemporary problems, primarily based on deciding what they wanted to do in terms of the church education material. And in preparing church education material, they went back and rethought some concepts about the nature of the church itself, the nature of Revelation, the nature of Scripture, the nature of God, most of which, in my humble opinion, were primary reaffirmations of things that I thought we'd always believed. But they were couched in theological terms, and they made references to current theological ideas, and to a large extent disturbed the people of the church. Not so much, I personally believe, because of what they said, as because of the way they came out. They were released clandestinely through one of our many underground presses, and someone made a big deal out of what had not been intended to be a big deal, and added to these position papers the concept of clandestine behavior, which you know would sell anything quickly and rapidly. Unfortunately, the presidency had not thought that one out, I think, in the manner that they should have, and in effect, material which might well have been presented to the church through the church newsletter or through the church magazine came out in a fashion which was harmful, I think, to their intention rather than to the ideas. If she's saying, well, this was this period of rethought, of reconsideration in the 60s, an important one, the answer is yes, most definitely. The church changed. I think there's no doubt about that. Some would say it liberalized. Others would say it retrenched. But it nevertheless rethought its position, and I think that did eventually change the nature of the church. One true church, and I'll quit and let Dick clean all this up for me, heard a marvelous response to this in a session this morning. What do you mean by one? What do you mean by true? What do you mean by church? Do I think the RLDS church as a denominational sect is the only one that has got anything to say to human beings? The answer is positively no. Do I think it is the church for me? The answer is yes. Do I think I could find a better one? The answer is no. If that means it's the one true church, I'm afraid I'm forced into that position, but I don't think so. I don't think that's what it means at all. I suspect what she wants to know is, do I think it is necessary to retain an RLDS identity which says that we are nothing like or we have nothing to do with anybody else? If that's what she's asking, my answer to that, of course, is no. I think it's very important that we recognize that God had a lot of things to say to a lot of people, and he has done so in many different ways. This one that I have learned to understand and to work with is one very important way, and I wouldn't downgrade that in the slightest. But it's not the only way. To suggest, I think, that the need to be the one true church is what will save us from any loss of identity, I think that's a very important point. I think there is a feeling in the RLDS Church that we are losing our identity because we're becoming too Protestant. And I don't know whether that's true or not. Maybe we get into the discussion. The three of us can talk about that a little more. We are certainly more Protestant than we were. Interestingly enough, Protestants have changed in the last few years as well. Whether we're all becoming more like something else, which is what I would intend to believe, or whether we actually are becoming more like the Protestants used to be, I really don't know. I do think there is a very strong feeling, and this is one of the reasons behind much of the dissent that exists in our movement, very strong feeling that we have betrayed some of the basic principles of the gospel, and that those principles of the gospel are defined at some particular time. And this goes back to what I'm talking about, this epistemological problem. We have people who say, this is not the church it was in the 1830s. And my response to that is, of course not. Did I do that? Last time I spoke at the Sunstones East about the temple, all the lights went out. So I'm beginning to get a little worried here. You know, I think the problem we're trying to deal with is that it is not the church of 1830. It's not the church of the 1860s. It's not the church of 1945. And for a church which believes as strongly as we do in the contemporary revelation and the impact of God in the modern world, there is no way it could be. And that's our problem. It's important for us, for most of us, to believe in that revelation. It is also important for most of us to respond to it. And that means we'll change. But
Peggy gave me four topics. The relation of theology to history, authority, Book of Mormon, its perception and status in the RLDS Church, and building the city of Zion in 15 minutes. For many RLDS people, church history and theology are so inseparable that they are nearly synonymous. By this I mean that the line between history and theology has been largely indistinguishable. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, for example, church history has been conceived and communicated as a record of God's repeated intervention on behalf of the RLDS people in their life events on both the individual and corporate levels. History viewed from such a strong theological orientation is, therefore, a theology in itself, albeit as unsystematic as the chaotic unfolding events of history are. I'll illustrate this coalescence between theology and history in the RLDS experience by citing one of the major bases for the existence of the RLDS Church in the minds of its early adherents and leaders. In section 124, verses 31 to 32 of the Doctrine and Covenants, we read these words, "I command you, all ye my saints," I knew if I read from the Doctrine and Covenants, the lights would be. "I command you, all my saints, to build a house unto me." This is Nauvoo. "And I grant unto you a sufficient time to build a house unto me, and during this time your baptisms shall be acceptable unto me. But behold, at the end of this appointment, your baptisms for your dead shall not be acceptable unto me. And if you do not these things, at the end of the appointment, you shall be rejected as a church with your dead, saith the Lord your God." Now, that all the Latter-day Saints took these lines of Scripture very seriously can be seen in the way that they responded variously to them, both at Nauvoo and afterward. After the death of Joseph and Hiram, Nauvoo Mormons worked feverishly to complete the Nauvoo Temple. As the time approached to flee Nauvoo from the Gentile wrath, the temple,
completed sufficiently for the whole line of esoteric rituals then in focus at Nauvoo, was hastily dedicated on the 30th of April and the 1st of May, 1846, by which time the Exodus was already underway. With great relief, the saints could leave Nauvoo for the West, saved from the divine threat of rejection. The early RLDS people, however, placed a very different interpretation on the closing events of Nauvoo history. Their beloved prophet Joseph Smith III remembered playing in what he often described as the unfinished temple at Nauvoo. Other RLDS people also recalled that the temple remained after the Exodus in a rather unfinished state, in need of much interior sanding and painting. As the early RLDS church launched its century-plus campaign to justify itself vis-a-vis Utah Mormonism, the theory of the rejection of the church soon came to have a great appeal, based as it was on two aspects of reality. First of all, the divine injunction in section 124, 31, and 32, and the lingering image of the unfinished Nauvoo temple. The strength of that appeal has only recently begun to fade, as it has become clear to RLDS leaders that to claim that the Nauvoo church was rejected with its dead is to weaken the very foundation of the church which they were seeking so diligently to establish and to justify. There's another sense in which theology has pervaded RLDS historical awareness and literature, particularly in the past decade or so. In the RLDS church's leadership, the most recent and definitive theological positioning set forth in the book Exploring the Faith in 1971, the major impact of neo-Orthodox Christian theological writers appears throughout nearly every one of the 19 theological position statements and the accompanying essays. The result has been a subtle and sometimes confusing shearing away of what had earlier been thought to be an historical awareness founded on dispensational theological interpretations of the human drama. RLDS minister Daniel McGregor's popular book of the 1920s, A Marvelous Work and a Wonder, heavily informed the RLDS presiding patriarch's Albert A. Smith's bestseller a generation later, called Restoration, A Study in Prophecy. The current RLDS theological framework, however, is acutely disjunctive with both of these titles and the theological framework which they represented. A final note on program implications of this disjunction between the current theological framework and the historical self-image of RLDS. 1985 marks the midpoint in the highly touted Faith to Grow decade. Church leaders have openly declared their goal of Christianizing the faith, of narrowing the gap between the historic faith of the Restoration and the classic Christian faith of the ages. This is, in my view, a staggering task which demands rigorous attention to both disciplines, theology and history, simultaneously, self-consciously, a permanent, evolving, dynamic, enriched by active engagement of the RLDS people at all levels of participation and in every jurisdiction. That is not happening just now. It is one of the crying needs I see. In my view, this is a theological and historical crisis of major proportions. Authority, my second topic. The RLDS Church has moved somewhat away from the early Latter-day Saint movement's insistence on the notion that divinely imposed authority, exclusively owned by Latter-day Saintism, was wholly denied and unavailable to other religious denominations. In its recurring effort to mark itself off from Utah Mormonism and to gain legitimacy in the eyes of the Christian world and society generally, the RLDS Church early moved towards accommodation with other religious traditions in the culture. And in that movement, outward from the exclusive authority center, RLDS people in the past 75 years have discovered a meaningful base for relativism, I should say, vis-a-vis religious authority. This is to say that when they have tried to take the authoritative gospel message to others, they have often been apprehended by a history of God's living presence, long at work, as a great power for good in those to whom they would have taken the gospel. They have discovered, in other words, that the Holy Spirit bloweth where it listeth, and cannot be clasped to or cornered by the boundaries of any one religious tradition or communion or institution. This discovery has had and is having significant and at times troubling results, one expression of which is the emerging practice of open communion in the RLDS church. RLDSism still officially embraces the closed communion principle, denying the Lord's Supper to unbaptized persons, whether children or adults. at the heart of the growing conflict between priesthood who cannot bring themselves to withhold the Lord's Supper from adults known to be committed Christians, and those who could under no circumstances offer those sacrificial emblems to anybody but baptized RLDS persons. At the heart of that conflict lies the issue of authority. At another level, the authority issue is joined in the struggle over ecumenism, which I define right now at this moment as the joining of forces by two or more religious communions for stated purposes of community enrichment without reference to any sort of doctrinal appeasement or accommodation. Some RLDS persons and groups abhor ecumenism under any guise, even when given the limited definition that I just stated. They cite Joseph Smith's words from the Times and Seasons report of his first vision as a justification for an exclusive authoritarian model. Join none of them, for they are wrong. Their leaders teach for doctrine that corrupts, you know those statements. Well, so we are in the process of working at authority in the RLDS Church. Now, I've just given you a couple of images of or arenas where that struggle continues. Third, the Book of Mormon, its perception and status among RLDS people. Until the 1960s, the Book of Mormon was viewed as a pre-Columbian history of ancient America translated through divine interposition. In the 1960s, however, RLDS research and publications raised hard questions that have been taken seriously by both leaders and members. As a result of these publications, archaeology is no longer officially sponsored by the Church as a vital means of vindicating the Book of Mormon as history. Whatever is done in this field is done privately by interested parties whose convictions lead them in that direction. James Lancaster's 1962 Saints Herald article on Book of Mormon translation raised the issue of magic in the production of the Book of Mormon, 1962. This stirred a crisis of credibility, which evoked strong defensive maneuvers from articulate spokespersons of the traditional views. The writings of others, such as Lee Niegaard, Roy Chavelle, Presiding Patriarch, Wayne Ham, William Russell, Susan Curtis, in the early 1970s raised the hard issue of pluralism in terms of how to perceive the Book of Mormon, because these authors pointed up various problems related to perceiving the Book of Mormon as an ancient historical record. These writers raised the issue of the extent to which Joseph Smith Jr. could be considered the author of the Book of Mormon. The RLDS Church has been very careful to avoid proscribing the conscience of belief of its members by requiring any single official interpretation of the meaning of the Book of Mormon and its message and its coming forth. Joseph Smith III, in a letter in 1894 to a member, stated, the person had written in and said, "Can you be a good Latter-day Saint and not accept the divine inspiration of the Book of Mormon?" And Joseph III wrote back and said, "I know many good Latter-day Saints who do not accept the divine inspiration of the Book of Mormon. But I also hold that if you do believe in the divine inspiration of the Book of Mormon, you make a better Latter-day Saint." His point was, we shall not proscribe the conscience of Latter-day Saints. We shall not make belief in the Book of Mormon as a divine record a test of fellowship in the church. And so the reorganized church, in a sense, has lived through the 20th century with a general awareness that that kind of proscription would be inappropriate to its historic faith. Finally, building the city of Zion. From the very start of his 54-year presidency, Joseph Smith III, the first RLDS president and son of the founding prophet, exerted strong leadership in an effort to affect, exerted strong leadership in an effort to bring about among the leaders and members of the church a very gradual gathering concept and procedure. He had people around him urging that the church move back to Missouri, reestablish Zion, reclaim their inheritances. He repeatedly warned from 1860 right on through to the end of the century that precipitous gatherings to build Zion would merely result in failure and disillusionment, and he instructed RLDS people to learn how to live out a strong and compassionate Christian witness wherever they happen to be. This, he reasoned, would over the years produce a quality and depth of community trust and relationship necessary for any effective endeavor to build Zion in any one location. The Gathering of the Saints, 1830 to 1846, had always ended in frustration, pain, disillusionment, and more often than not, forcible removal of the saints from their chosen gathering places. Realizing this made the RLDS gathering attempts very conservative, very deliberate, very slow, and oftentimes, right on down to our present day, very remote from official sanction and sponsorship. Several attempts to establish the Order of Enoch in 1870 in Lamoni, Iowa, again in 1910 in Independence, Missouri, have also been based on practical economic needs and resources of participating stewards, with no discernible emphasis upon the eschatological dream and expectation of early Latter-day Saints. Now, in the late 20th century, a multiplicity of meanings and images and forms of Zion building are now being offered from the pens of church leaders, which to some more traditionally minded saints seem sort of out of joint with the vibrant hope of the early saints. But to others, these new images and meanings and forms offer opportunities to see Zion building holistically, to encompass the eschatological dimension, at the same time to combine them with a compassionate concern for elevating the quality of Christian corporate witness wherever the church attempts to make operational its Zionic ideals. I will not make any further statements about the one true church. I think I covered that under authority. Thank you.
Gary gave you about six topics I was asked to address. I'm going to address four of them and hopefully touch on two of them in addressing the four. I will discuss the four aspects of our priesthood, lay ministry, how priesthood callings are made, who are the appointees, and briefly touch on ordaining women. The grassroots ministry of the RLDS Church is provided by its local membership, including both non-priesthood and priesthood. A statement that I have heard many times in our church is attributed to Joseph Smith III. He said that the highest office in the church is that of a member in good standing. For several years, we have been utilizing children, women, non-priesthood men, priesthood in our worship services and in our commission systems. I would say that about 95% of our branches are pastored by lay ministers such as myself, who on Monday mornings arise and go to our various professions, work our 40 or 60 or whatever hours a week it takes, and in the meantime and in between try to do to the best of our ability our church responsibilities. The branches also look to their lay memberships to fill the many positions within the branch, and we fill a lot of these through branch elections. We utilize what we term commissions to implement our worship, Christian education, missionary, stewardship, leadership development, pastoral care, and community involvement endeavors. All members of the branch are encouraged to serve on one or more of these commissions. The RLDS Church also has a small group of people, less than 200, that we call appointees. Appointees are priesthood members who have been called to minister full-time for the church. Their family expenses are paid by the church. 70, high priest, bishop, apostle, of which we have 12, evangelist patriarch, and the office of presidency, of which Dr. Wallace B. Smith is our president and his two counselors are Alan Tyree and Howard Sheehy, and they are appointees also. Appointees serve and function in several ways. First, we have a church headquarters staff, and we have two examples here today. Dick Howard is our church historian, and Dr. Edwards is our director of Temple School. Secondly, appointees also function as field administrators. These are usually apostles and high priests, and they have such titles as field administrators, regional administrators, stake or district presidents, and they are typically responsible for geographic areas which may be quite small, or they may be quite large, such as several states or several countries. And they are charged with implementing the church programs and coordinating the church activities in their specific geographic area. They also function in sort of a pastoral role for the lay, district, and stake leaders in their fields. Appointees can also function as missionaries, teachers, and counselors. 70s are typically assigned to smaller geographic areas, and they coordinate the missionary and expansion activities of the church in those jurisdictions. Their activities may include actual teaching of prospective members, and also includes the training of lay ministry and the techniques of teaching prospective members. The 70 is usually an informal counselor to the district or stake presidency and to the pastors in the areas and where he serves. I'd also like to talk next about calling of priesthood. The process by which a person is called to priesthood service is a careful one, which tries to address the needs of the congregation where that person will serve, and also seek confirmation through the Holy Spirit that God is indeed calling a particular individual to a specific function. This call can be self-understood, but cannot be asserted until it has been expressed through others who have administrative responsibility. First, calls to priesthood are perceived by appropriate administrative officers, themselves priesthood called of God. Not just one such officer, but at least another, must bear testimony of the witness of the Holy Spirit in each call in order for there to be a reasonable assuredness of the genuineness of this foundational element in priesthood authority. Second, while weakness will be found in the life of every person called, very private, but reasonably comprehensive inquiry is made to assure that the life of each person called is in harmony with the teachings and practices of the church, the body that the people will serve. Third, with appropriate assurance of the authenticity of the call and the acceptable quality of life, the person is advised of the call and given opportunity to express willingness to serve. Often the Holy Spirit blesses that person with an independent testimony of God's call to him or her, which is very reassuring. Others respond in faith to the general commitment that they have made to serve the Lord to the best of their ability. And either response, from knowledge or from faith, is an acceptable response of the individual disciple. Fourth, after the call, examination, and affirmative response from the individual have occurred, the determination of the acceptance by the people is sought. This is best determined by vote of a conference of the congregation or jurisdiction of the church having knowledge of the individual. In cases where the church is not yet planted or the sufficiently organized to have a conference, an apostle may act to express the acceptability of the candidate by the church. And fifth, an additional dimension of the authority of priesthood members is the competency with which ministry is offered to the body. Both before ordination and after, the quality with which the ministers act for persons and things pertaining to God commends their ministry to God and to the church, and lends it an authority of competence. It is to reinforce this dimension of priesthood authority that standards of preordination and continuing education are offered. Once these various procedures have been duly completed, a person is ordained to his or her particular priesthood office by the laying on of hands of those in authority or those who have been, in other words, previously ordained. Priests in the Aaronic priesthood are able to ordain other members of that priesthood. Elders in the Melchizedek priesthood can ordain persons to that office or any of the Aaronic priesthood offices. It is understood that although authority comes from God, it is through the agency of the church that the call is expressed. Priesthood members are held accountable to the church for their conduct and must abide by the policies, procedures, and authorities which have been set in place to regulate the affairs of the church. I'd like now to briefly address women in the priesthood. The April 1984 World Conference of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints accepted as the mind and will of God a document presented by our prophet, Wallace B. Smith, containing instructions that we should not be surprised if that women are being called to the priesthood. And we took this as authority to ordain women to the priesthood. Through mid-July 1985, the First Presidency had processed from various field jurisdictions 104 callings for women to priesthood offices. Of that number, 99 were approved. At this time, only callings to the Aaronic priesthood and to the office of elder are being considered. The 99 approved callings were distributed as follows: 4 deacons, 20 teachers, 38 priests, and 37 elders. It is interesting that these women range in age from 25 to 79, and that the majority of these women are married, and that the majority of the married women are married to priesthood members themselves. I have received and processed 2 callings for women in the Salt Lake City branch. These were processed through the proper channels and have been accepted by the women called and by the branch. They were presented to our branch business meeting, our branch annual branch business meeting on July the 21st. And I have to admit that I went to that meeting with a lot of preparation and with a lot of apprehension. And it was one of the most spiritual experiences that I've had in my life. Each person was considered separately, and several members spoke in favor of each call. And there was one member who spoke in opposition to each call. And I think that his opposition was more against the concept rather than the people. You know, when you're supposed to be speaking to a specific call, the concept had already been approved. Because of the calling of women being new in the church, we voted on the callings in a secret ballot, and I must say that's unorthodox also. And it was a local option that we exercised, and it's not universally used. However, I think it got a truer percentage, a truer feeling of the congregation. 80% of the people voted for each of the women, and 20% either chose to vote against the women involved or to abstain from voting. Those 2 women will, along with all the other women thus far authorized throughout the RLDS Church, be ordained on Sunday, November the 17th at special ordination services throughout the world. Many women have ministered to me throughout the years and have helped me in the development of my faith, and I personally look forward to the additional ministry that our saints will be receiving from the ordained women of our church. Thank you.
As you've heard each of them tell you the different topics they were assigned, it sounded like a lot to cover in 20 minutes. Well, I'm assigned all their topics, and to contrast that to Mormonism in the same time, so you can guess how far we'll get. I am not going to be speaking technical theology because that's out of my league, but I think I'll be speaking so that lay people can understand me. And I'm not presenting official church policy as the church would see it, but as I see it, and there may be a difference there, and I'm trying to also present commonly held beliefs among Mormons as I see them. I'm going to remind you of an article that Robert Woodward wrote in Newsweek a while back. It was the one with the headline about Mother in Heaven. It mentioned that Mormons don't believe in the atonement. Well, we all knew we believed in the atonement, but no talking to him would convince him of that because his perception of atonement was far different from ours. And if I am guilty of doing the same thing to the RLDS beliefs, it's not malicious, it's not intentional, it's simply that I'm not informed enough. I also need to point out that I will probably be harsher on the LDS Church than I will be on the RLDS Church as I contrast these two. What I'm going to do is give you the RLDS view on one hand and then give you the Mormon view that I see contrasts it. I'm going to start with the nature of God because for lack of a better reason, the third lecture on faith suggests that we must have a correct idea about God in order to be saved. So for the RLDS side, they believe that God is a supreme being. For the LDS side, we believe that God is our supreme being, but he probably had and has a supreme being over him. For the RLDS side, God is unchangeable, perfect in knowledge and power. For the LDS side, God was once mortal, and he evolved and progressed to godhood. His progression continues, whether we're talking about power, kingdoms, knowledge, or whatever. For the RLDS side, God is probably male, perhaps anthropomorphic, but neither is very significant at all. Our being in his image is figurative. We emulate his attributes rather than mirror his form. There is no thought of a mother in heaven. On our side, God is anthropomorphic and male, and both are very significant. He almost certainly has a female counterpart, for he begat mortals, if you want to believe Brigham Young. We are literally in his physical image. And I need to stop here for just a second to acknowledge that I began this knowing about the RLDS faith through the writings of people like Paul Edwards. And I figured that that probably would give me a very distorted view. And so on Monday night, I called up Brother Troyer so that I could get a little more... That's right. A little more middle-of-the-road view. And so Brother Troyer very kindly consented to speak with me with his first counselor, and I really learned a lot about what I think the majority of their people may think. On the RLDS side, back to the nature of God again. God is a mystery. On the LDS side, we don't want mysteries, and we make every effort to clear up every mystery we find. On the RLDS side, the only necessary thing in the universe is God. Everything else's existence is contingent upon God's existence. On the LDS side, God is co-eternal with us and with law and with matter. Our existence and law's existence and matter's existence is not dependent upon God. He exists within, but he did not create time and space. For the RLDS, God created ex nihilo, creating us and the laws of the universe from nothing. For the LDS side, he created from existing ingredients, working within existing law. For the RLDS, God works alone, except perhaps for creating through Jesus Christ and saving us through him. And as Paul said, Jesus Christ is God's contact with man and man's contact with God. But we'll talk about this a little bit more in just a second. God and Jesus are not necessarily separate beings, though there is some idea of separateness in the RLDS faith. Now, in contrast, if you're LDS, God had companions in creation, whether we're talking about Jesus Christ or Mother in Heaven, or the Book of Abraham tells us the gods helped create. And then, as the RLDS, God saves us through Jesus Christ. The points that are very common to us both are that God acts in history, particularly in our common history, and that God is a personal God. Now let me get to the subject of Jesus and God and their relationship to one another. And what I found in the RLDS was very undefined, and Paul alluded to that and said that there's a reason for it being undefined as well. As a Mormon, LDS Mormon, I kept wanting to pin it down, but I really couldn't do it. In any of the writings and speaking, it's a mystery, says Paul. For them, the relationship between God and Jesus is far more like traditional Christian Trinitarianism, where there are three in one and they work together, than it is like Mormon tritheism, where there are three separate and distinct beings who are the Godhead together, which is the LDS view. For the RLDS, Jesus is God incarnate, which is something that the LDS hardly even know the meaning of the word, let alone would embrace. For both of us, Jesus is God's Son. For both of us, Jesus is the Savior of humans. For the RLDS, I hope this distinction is fair. I'm not certain that it is. God created through Jesus. Don't pin me down. For the LDS, Jesus created taking direction from God, and I would use the temple ceremony as my basis to say that. For the RLDS, Jesus is our point of connection with God and his with us, and Jesus is the self-expression of God, God revealed as a person. We've got no counterpart to those thoughts. Okay, on to the perception of human beings. For the RLDS, people are God's creatures and are totally dependent upon him for existence. And again, Paul said that's not absolutely firm, but probably. For the LDS, as intelligences, we existed prior to God's turning us into human beings. We are not his creatures, but rather we are co-eternal with him. For the RLDS, I may be way off here, human's nature is basically neutral, equally capable of good or bad, not really tainted by Adam's sin, but having a vague sense of sinfulness nonetheless. For the LDS, human nature is basically neutral, though the balance is tipped in favor of good, and we are absolutely not tainted by Adam's sin. For the RLDS, Christ has made salvation available to all, and I don't know what qualifications are on that, but for the LDS, Christ has made salvation available to all who merit it by virtue of their good works. So let me mention salvation for just a minute. For the RLDS, salvation comes through the grace of God by virtue of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, which makes us forgiven persons. That's a near quote from some of the literature. For the LDS, salvation is possible because of the atonement of Christ, but not certain. For the RLDS, the grace of God is an undeserved gift from God, and you can't do anything to deserve salvation. For the LDS, we are largely dependent upon doing good works for winning salvation. Well, winning salvation says something. And we are also, to some extent, dependent upon participating in the proper ordinances. For the RLDS, the ultimate reward is eternal life in the celestial kingdom. For the LDS, the ultimate reward is godhood, creating worlds, or a world, to rule over. And I asked Sid and his counselor about this, and something struck me here. They said that the reward in heaven was not necessarily a very big motivator for doing good in this world. And that seemed to me to be a real contrast with Mormonism, because you do a lot to earn your eternal reward, or you avoid doing things which would lose your eternal reward for you. And I see the hereafter as a very big motivator in Mormondom, LDS Mormondom. Okay, some things about the churches themselves, how they perceive themselves, and how they're made up. I see in the RLDS humility that I don't see in the LDS. They feel chosen to serve, but they have a willingness to admit that the church sometimes loses sight of its purpose, sometimes becomes self-centered, is bent upon its own survival sometimes, and sometimes resorts to carrying on business as usual without accomplishing anything significant. I could hardly believe it when I read that. For the LDS Church, I think there's a lot of pride that we are chosen to be God's people on earth. We are God's kingdom. We have no public corporate admission of mistakes that I can see, lots of self-centeredness, and we do lots of carrying on business as usual without accomplishing anything significant. In addition, we are extremely defensive. For the LDS, church leaders are called by God and are inspired, but are not beyond taking suggestions and criticism, and there is a forum where the leadership can hear from the membership and where the membership's ideas can make a real difference. For the LDS Church, church leaders are called by God and are inspired and are beyond taking suggestions and criticism. And if you don't believe me, look at the Tribune's account of Dallin Oates' speech. There is no built-in mechanism for the leadership to hear from the members, and as Dallin Oates said, it is never appropriate to criticize any leader called by God. That's the Tribune's version of Dallin Oates. He may have a different version. Okay, for the RLDS, the leadership is very progressive and innovative, enough to make members uncomfortable sometimes. For the LDS, the leadership resists change and doggedly preserves the status quo and makes the members uncomfortable sometimes. For the RLDS, the membership can propose and vote to implement change. For the LDS, change comes from the top down and members vote to ratify change. The purpose for the RLDS Church is, this is a quote, to bring the reality of God's love into the life of each person. The purpose for the LDS Church is to help people attain salvation. I took that from John Widsoe's Irrational Theology. For the RLDS, there is a recognition that it might not be a restoration of a specific New Testament church that Jesus instituted while he was living on the earth. For the LDS, we are exactly what restoration says. We are a restoration of a New Testament church instituted by Jesus. An implication of that is that the RLDS people, as I have heard, aren't yet willing to come to grips with the theological implications of having the restoration not be a restoration. For the LDS, we don't have to deal with the question because it is a restoration. Okay, on to ecumenism in the church, its commonality with Christianity at large. For the RLDS, they use many terms and concepts that are recognizable to and common to the rest of Christianity. For the LDS, our language is all our own, and even commonly used Christian words have unique Mormon definitions. For the RLDS, they're moderately suspicious of mainstream Christian theology. The LDS absolutely rejects mainstream Christian theology if it knows that's what it is. For the RLDS, the purpose is very compatible with the purpose of Christianity at large. For the LDS, the purpose is unique to it. The rest of Christianity disdains our notion that salvation is available only through our ordinances and theology, and we feel superior to the rest of Christianity because we have the truth. Therefore, the LDS Church has cut off all possibility for dialogue, and we see no benefit to be gained by it. The RLDS Church sponsors situations where one can accomplish good works and joins with others in doing good works. The LDS Church does a lot of good works as well, but it usually directs it to its own members. It's very good at disaster relief and generally invites others to join with it when it sponsors a disaster relief program, with the one exception of the fast held this past winter, where we joined with Catholic relief organizations and other Protestant organizations to give money to Ethiopia. We almost never encourage our members to join in efforts sponsored by others. The RLDS affiliate with other Christian churches on local levels, whereas the LDS has no standing affiliation with other Christian groups on any level. And again, let me quote from the Tribune's view of Dallin Oaks' speech. Quote, "We persistently disdain the comfortable fraternity of ecumenical Christianity," end quote. Talking about worship, this is really quick and very superficial. Their structure is loose. Suggestions come from the hierarchy. For the LDS, there is one way to structure a meeting, and the hierarchy provides direction that it intends to have followed. For the RLDS, the most significant parts of its worship, I got this from Sid, and I hope I'm reproducing this correctly, what is done from the pulpit is almost always done by someone who is a priesthood member. Therefore, to this point, that means it's been male. For the LDS, all preaching in our vernacular talks and prayers are open to males and females from the teenage years onward. Okay, on priesthood, again, this is fairly superficial. I just picked a couple of points. For the RLDS, it is potentially open to everyone worthy, and in practice is given to a minority of those worthy members. For the LDS, it is given almost automatically to almost every male who is remotely worthy. For the RLDS, I won't give you that example. For the RLDS, its purpose is service, and I'm going to presume, I hope I'm right, that because they're more selective in how they approve and designate priesthood members, abuse of power is probably much more rare in the RLDS Church than it is in the LDS Church, where priesthood is given less discriminately. On the Book of Mormon, again, this is fairly superficial, but the RLDS is open to critical evaluation. The LDS is open to pseudo-critical evaluation. That means evaluation using any methods or sources that will reassure us all that it is historical and that it is replete with useful religious truth. For the RLDS, there is some admission that its historicity might be questionable. For the LDS, there's no possibility of that. In the LDS Church, belief that the Book of Mormon is true separates the believers from the non. Now, one problem I see with the RLDS position is that, again, there has been some reluctance to deal, at least in print, with the theological implications about the authority of the Church and about its original prophet if the Book of Mormon is not what it claims to be. For the LDS, we don't have to deal with the problem because it is what it claims to be. On the notion of true church, I take this again from Sid and his counselor, primarily his counselor. The true church, the RLDS see their church more as the truest available church more true than any other, but very accepting of truth and goodness wherever it's found. The LDS Church seems much more arrogant in an insistence that it is the only true church. We do have some tradition of accepting truth and accepting goodness wherever it's found, but I think we don't practice that very much, at least from any official level. And more prevalent is the misconception, this is not official, that we are the only church with any truth, and the denial that there is any goodness but ours. I will just end by saying that I'm jealous of what I see as an openness to critical study, to the good that can come from associating with other Christians, with uniting in purpose with other Christians, that I see in the RLDS Church, and I wish that we were moving more in that direction. On the other hand, I was seduced in a class by Hugh Carlisle Hunsaker and by reading the writings of Sterling McMurrin to think that the theology of the LDS Church has some very nice aspects about it that lend a lot of dignity to human beings in making us something other than God's creatures, other than being tainted by sin, and people who have some responsibility to work out their own salvation by doing something specific good for other people. Thank you.
I don't envy Melody's job there. I suspect what this may demonstrate more than anything else is that it is the impossibility of the task. I suspect that there are sufficient differences within the LDS Church that many of the statements that she made would be taken issue with by members of one viewpoint or another within the LDS Church, and that may be true within the RLDS Church, and I don't know whether to open this up for rebuttal on one side or the other exclusively for the sake of time. I have a feeling before we do have a few minutes for questions, and that list was so exhaustive and fast that perhaps members of the panel would like to respond to something that Melody said before we open it to questions. Has anybody got any burning response that they want to make to her list? Okay, well, let's open it then, right here.
In 1968, Michael Marquardt came to our general conference in Independence, and at the end of a very stormy business session, he came to my office, and his eyes were just really bugged out, and he says, "I can't believe it." And I said, "What can't you believe?" And he says, "The way you talk back to your prophet." I think that's probably one of the most distinctive things we have going for us in the RLDS Church. The people do feel very free to tell the president of the church what they think about what he thinks. But no, we don't have any counterpart to that missionary system at all. And, of course, no temple ordinances to this point.
Mm-hmm. We most definitely do not wear temple underwear. And probably the most outstanding thing about us is, I suppose, getting any of us to wear any underwear at all.
Lori?
I think that's good. You're making a good point. I think I use restoration as a noun. It's the name of the organization I belong to, which sometimes calls itself Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I think Dick's description of the RLDS attitude toward restoration was just right on. I don't think most of us really know what it was that was restored, and we're not really convinced that whatever it was restored in the way it was. We don't find any biblical evidence of there being a church like we put one together. And so if we're saying restored in that sense, I think that there's a lot of very loose feelings. I think most of us would tend to believe that restored implies the fulfilling of God's contemporary involvement in the lives of human beings, and that is the whole concept of the latter days, and that we were involved in the movement which responded to that. And thus, we are a part of the restoration movement. But I think you're absolutely right. I don't think that we use it in the sense that it was designed originally to be used. Well, I think we'd buy that, but I think the problem we get into is when it starts to be interpreted as restoration of an original church, And as I say, looking backwards, I don't find any churches anywhere in there that looked like us. So if we're saying restoration of the contemporary aspect of Revelation, certainly, I think we've, yeah. Yeah, did you want to? Well, it's more than a movement. It's as we understand it, it is a command. I mean, we've been told to get ready to build it. Only catch is we don't know what to build. Yeah. We may all be end up wearing temple underwear. I don't know. Which would be an improvement. Yeah.
Okay, back here.
I think to sum up the attitude of the RLDS Church today on that matter, I'm not sure the church has an attitude. I think basically that the people at the grassroots level are still there with that publication of the 1940s. Yes. Quote, officially, I don't know. It seems to me like we would say that the answer on that is not altogether conclusive, that polygamy per se was erroneous at the time that it was instituted, whenever that happened, and that if Joseph Smith did in fact institute and practice polygamy, he was wrong. That's about as close as I can get to the way the officials of the Reorganized Church would talk about that today. Mm-hmm.
Back here. Yeah.
My father-in-law, after he retired, became a guide at the Kirtland Temple. And I remember going there when I was young enough to be impressed that he would say this. When he informed me that it was easy for him, when he saw people come to the temple, the house right across the street, he'd run over and talk to them, but he wasn't in too big a hurry if they were Mormons. And I said, well, how do you know they're Mormons if you're sitting over here? He says, I can smell them. Now that may be an extreme position, but not really. What he means is he can't smell them. They're so clean he can't smell them. And what I'm trying to say here is I think we're about one generation away from some pretty deep wounds. Pretty deep wounds. I think at the Kirtland Temple, our guides and your missionaries clash. They run up against still. It's much more polite than it used to be, but there's still a lot of sensitivity. I think the place where they're getting together the most is at this organization and at the MHA, and the John Whitmer Historical Association, where I find a give and take that is, to me, is extremely important. And I'm learning and hopefully passing on to my own people much of the good things that I find in the LDS movement. I hope that from those exchanges we occasionally share something of our concerns and beliefs. But I don't think there's any dialogue of any extended kind. Dick might know more about it than I would.
Let me just add something myself. My great-great-grandfather was John Smith, the son of Hiram. And while he was in the valley and certainly a Brighamite, some of the sons of Joseph came out and on their missions. And that was a time of great bitterness between the two churches. And John used to welcome them and extend hospitality, and he wrote in his journal how many of the Brighamites would call him a Josephite in a very pejorative way, and he wrote that they can call him what they want, but he was a Christian also. And so there were some examples of reaching out even in the most bitterest of times, but it certainly was a difficult time, and I suspect that people a generation ago would be very surprised to see this panel taking place here today. And I think it's good that this sort of thing can take place now. Over on this side, yes.
I think that Nauvoo was a tremendous metamorphosis for Mormonism. I think the terrible tragedy at Nauvoo, ending in the deaths of Joseph and Hiram Smith and the splitting of the church into factional groups, was such a painful memory for many of those who coalesced in Wisconsin and Illinois to frame the Reorganized Church, that I think there was so much psychic pain over that whole Nauvoo experience and so much confusion. Confusion over the sense that I think they deeply believed in things like baptism for the dead. They had extended themselves to build a temple. They were identified with that. On the other hand, they were also, from the outset, deeply offended by the advent of polygamy, and they didn't know what to do with that. And so I think that that the growth apart came once young Joseph came into focus as the leader in 1860. And he said he raised his banner on that day, April 6, 1860, when he said, "My father never could have sponsored the doctrine of polygamy." He raised the banner, and that became, over the next generation of time, the clarion call to disavow the character and the meaning of Nauvoo. So that by the mid-20th century, we had completely forgotten all about Nauvoo. We took all of our signals for our self-image out of the Kirtland period, or earlier, if we could. We did the impossible. We could not do that. Nauvoo lay smoldering underneath in the, shall I say, the psychic unconscious of the RLDS Church. And when Robert Flanders brought that into focus in his book in 1965, he touched off what I would like to call a kind of a wave of, I don't know what to call it. It's just a deep emotional sense of tragedy, a sense of rejection, a sense of disillusionement that still is being worked at and worked out by the RLDS people. And in the whole century of warfare, I would call it warfare, between RLDS and LDS representatives in the public arena at the level of the United States Congress during the Edmunds and the Act and all that, during that time, the lines were so deeply drawn and the walls were so thickly built that we just simply stopped talking the same language. And we identified with our Protestant establishment communities wherever we were scattered and dispersed. And when we did come together, it was only a very small group of people that came together. So that in Independence Today, our world headquarters, we comprised less than 10% of the population of the city, far outnumbered by Baptists. When you say, how did we get to be so far away? I think it was the trauma of Nauvoo, and the fact of Joseph. You folks got the church; we got the prophet, if you want to say it that way. you took the church with you when you went west. We always said no. They didn't. They were a sect. You know, we always said that. We always tried to minimize the thousands of people that went west by saying that we were the continuation of the original church. And when we said that, I think we had in mind, we continued Kirtland. And we just wiped Nauvoo right off the map, right off the board. And that essentially then kept us separate from you for so many, many decades of time. There was another part of your question, and if you can remember what it was, maybe you could talk to that. But I think I tried to at least address the first part.
We'll have to do this again, obviously. Thank you very much for your attention.